Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Welcome to the Carolina Outdoors. We're now in session. Come on in. The listening is fine. Your host on this edition of the Carolina Outdoors, as well as the other ones, Bill Barty, right here in front of the microphone. We're here to talk about outdoors. This episode's going to be no different. We're going to talk to Chris Crawley. He's the captain and CEO of Coastal Expeditions. He's been deeply involved in the creeks, rivers, and oceans of the Charleston area for the past 30-plus years, and we're going to learn something. We're going to learn because not only is he a CEO and captain, he is one of the nation's top naturalists, and of course, what a playground that he has to be a naturalist in. So we're going to learn a little bit about the wildlife, the estuary, and ecosystem that we have in the low country of South Carolina. But we don't want to leave out much in the Carolinas, so we're going to go to the total opposite end of the Carolina outdoors for a conversation with lead guide and instructor from Jesse Brown's Outdoors. Of course, Jesse Brown's is the mothership of the Carolina Outdoors, as well as WBT. But if you like listening to the program but miss a segment or two along the way, you can always go to jessebrowns.com to listen in. One of the foundational sports that we have at Jesse Brown's is fly fishing. And again, that lead guide and instructor, Dave Bergman, is going to join the program to talk about what they have in North Carolina in regards to trout fishing. It's a protection place, really as a subset of hatchery-supported waters called delayed harvest. We oftentimes talk about it here on the Carolina Outdoors. We're going to find out why it is important from Dave Bergman for us taking up the sport of fly fishing. Namely, accessibility is one. Ease of access from the Charlotte market is the other. You can access some of the closest delayed harvest trout streams in a matter of an hour and 20 minutes from the center of Charlotte, hour and 45 minutes. It makes it an easy day trip. And of course, our guides at Jesse Brown's through the tutelage of Dave Bergman meet you streamside. Everything is included in those trips, whether it be a chosen lunch, a sandwich of some degree, and then, of course, a day of education, tutelage, and learning the sport of fly fishing. We also like to go beyond the borders of the Carolinas to talk about some things going on, one of which we are excited to report because they've had a tough 5 years out west in the drier places. But the Colorado snowpack that has been out there it's been down in recent years, like I said, in the past 5 years, they are now releasing it. Federal operators of the Glen Canyon Dam, which is the dam that sits atop the Grand Canyon, have opened up the jets to a surge of water. They're calling it a pulse of whooshing water through the Colorado River as it curves throughout the base of the canyon. The U.S. Bureau of Reclamation officials say that they'll maintain the surge throughout the week, this upcoming week, ensuring a flow for 72 hours at over 39,000 cubic feet per second of water. This is a whole big, huge increase rather than what they normally do, but part of it has to do with the snowpack that is beginning to melt in Colorado. So they're managing the water out there. And we've heard a lot about water and water usage over the years. Not necessarily here in the Southeast or in the Carolinas, but it has been a big topic out west. Listen, we also, if you missed it, Storytellers Night at Jesse Brown's occurred this past week. We're looking to put it up via social media and also the website jessebrowns.com, as well as a recap of the urban hike. Congratulations to the folks who turned out for that. We had over 40 hikers who took on some of the greenways and walkways of Southern Charlotte. Southeast Charlotte is where we were, and of course we got off the beaten path a bit, but it was a wild success. That recap, again, will be pushed out via Facebook, Instagram, and at jessebrowns.com. It was a wonderful day. This took place last Sunday at 1 o'clock. We look forward to doing some more outings with our listeners to the Carolina Outdoors and our friends over at Jesse Brown's. Speaking of Jesse Brown's, it is the season, whether it be graduation season or, of course, it's always could be anniversary season, wedding season, birthday season. But with graduation, we do have customized abilities to monogram and customize items like pocket knives, Yeti drinkware, all available there at Jesse Brown's, jessebrowns.com as well. So, hey, with no further ado, I see TJ waving his hands, pushing the red buttons and the orange buttons and a few of the yellow buttons as we kick off the next three segments of the Carolina Outdoors. The Carolina Outdoors is in session. Your host, Bill Barty, on this side of your radio dial. Of course, we are heading straight into May, and it's a wonderful time in the Carolinas to enjoy being outdoors. The hiking is wonderful. The fishing is wonderful, whether it be at the coast, whether it be the riverways, whether it be our area lakes, or whether it be in the mountains and how you fish. We've done programs on this, the different types of fishing. But from Jesse Brown's Outdoors, the main type of fishing that we are promoting and helping people participate in is fly fishing. And as we focus on the month of May, as we broadcast the Carolina Outdoors right now, May is a fantastic time to take up the sport of fly fishing. Now, North Carolina, over 30 years ago, invested in a program called the Delayed Harvest Program. And we've talked to biologists from the state of North Carolina about the Delayed Harvest Program that goes along with the wild trout and hatchery supported. But over at Jesse Brown's, we're going to focus in on, at least at this station, Delayed Harvest and have that conversation. And by doing so, we're going to bring on lead guide and instructor. He's a man who's helping people learn the sport of fly fishing, bringing new anglers into the sport. His name? Dave Bergman. Dave, thanks for joining us here on the Carolina Outdoors.
Hello.
Man, it's great to have you on here. Now, Dave, you heard that introduction, and we're just going to jump in feet first to talk a little bit about it. I mentioned delayed harvest, and that's where the state stocks waters during the month of October and throughout, and then they allow harvesting, keeping of the fish, the first Saturday in June. How important has the Delayed Harvest Program been for the sport of fly fishing, especially as you take out clients who are new to the sport or maybe they're honing their craft within the sport?
So Delayed Harvest is very good at having good access for anglers that are beginners. And it is pretty, I would say, misunderstood that the fishing can be really easy when the fish are fresh, but then you get the added learning experience of fish that have been there for a while and seen a lot of flies. So you get these kind of neutral fish and negative fish that will eat, but you kind of have to know what you're doing. So teamed with me, who's been fishing on these waters for a long time, and being able to, that's matched with fish that are either going to be really easy to catch or kind of neutral, as in, you know, they may not pick up on the same things you were throwing last week, as like a wild fish might be really opportunistic and kind of go after anything you throw at it. These fish, you'll get a learning experience of actually being able to figure out what they're eating, going down to size. Maybe they're, last week they were eating black Pat's rubber leg, and next week they won't even touch them because they've seen so many of them. But the best thing about the Delayed Harvest River is that typically you can move around pretty easily, and you can fish a lot of different water in a day and learn a lot within 7 hours. So it's been pretty important and pretty helpful for a lot of people getting into the sport. And sometimes you get those days where the fishing's just insanely good. So yes. If that happens, and when that happens, you know, you're pretty much stuck on it. So.
Well, and that's the goal, too, for us at Jesse Brown's. I'm going to focus in on something you said. For people that are new to the sport, and Dave, there's access, of course, that you mentioned, and there's the fish, which are there, and you mentioned. But what's the biggest challenge for new anglers who are going out on a trip? Is it how to handle their line, the equipment? Is it casting? Is it understanding the entomology of fly fishing and the insects around us? What's the biggest challenge for new anglers?
I'd say the biggest challenge for new anglers, so there's two different kinds of new anglers. There's new anglers who've done a lot of research and due diligence, and there's new anglers who are just trying it, have never had any experience with it before. And the challenge for the new anglers who've never done it before is really going to be not so much the casting. I work smarter, not harder. I make it really easy for people, really approachable. Everybody has success. But it's really going to be the fish playing, the fighting the fish. They don't realize that you really have to be easy on the pressure. And we get a lot of people death gripping the line and holding on too tight, and that 6x tippet just breaks on a big fish. Luckily, we usually get multiple shots at bigger fish on trips with me. Yeah. But, you know, that's really, as far as hooking fish, you know, they get the hang of it, especially since they've learned no bad habits. Everything's new. So if they listen to everything that they're being taught, usually they pick it up pretty quick. If you get anglers who have done due diligence and read a lot of books, now you got a different challenge. The challenge is you've got to try to break down a lot of that and reveal to them what's going to be important to focus on and what's going to be less important to focus on. You see a lot, you know, they might start using too much line. They might start using flies that they think should work based on a calendar, but at that specific river aren't really working at that time. With me, never really an issue. But most people are going to listen to what I tell them is going to work best. And if they want to experiment with stuff, my box is always open. So it's, you know, it's going to be tailored to what they want to learn. But the biggest challenge with a new angler who has been doing a lot of reading is just making sure that they focus on the things that are important to start, and then they can move on to some of the other things that they've been learning in their texts or on the internet or whatever that may be.
That's the voice of Dave Bergman, lead guide and instructor at Jesse Brown's Outdoors on the sport of fly fishing. And he takes wading trips of all shapes and sizes, getting people out into the sport. And Dave, with that, those two different breakdowns of client, the brand new ones or the ones who've done some research and have some knowledge after a trip, or maybe it's three quarters of the way through a trip. And I know you hear them talking, clients who you're spending the day with, teaching the sport, building this foundation within fly fishing. Is there a big, or the biggest surprise, the biggest takeaway that clients talk about from a day on the water with you learning to fly fish?
Yes, I'm going to refer to some of my big game deep sea fishermen who come out and say that they had a fantastic time catching these fish that are basically bait for what they're catching. And it's a totally different experience. It's a very physical way to fish. It's a very interactive way to fish, and you go to very, very nice places to do it. So there's a lot of takeaway from it. Most people who are multifaceted in fishing definitely like to pick up the small stream trout fishing as well. It's just a kind of a magical experience. And like I said, I like to make it easy for people. I don't like to yell if they're losing fish or missing strikes. You know, I like to make sure that they are having an easy time with the walking, if maybe there's some restrictions on that. Try to walk a little more, go to some more rocky places with some more physically fit anglers who want more adventure, and kind of just tailoring it to what you want within reason. You know, there is going to be some expertise I'll have in certain places, and most people are willing to listen to that. But as far as everything else, I'm pretty much open to whatever experience you would like to have. So there's always a big takeaway from my trips.
Of course, here in the Carolinas, we do have the benefit of being able to fish 12 months of the year, including trout fishing. It is open 12 months of the year. You can find a trout stream to fish on with fish in the water. The weather suits so that you're able to get out. I guess, Dave, with that being, there is still a sense of urgency because right now we are in a bit of the magic time, I would say, for the next, as we move through May and June. Is it really the worst time of year? If there was a worst time, would be late summer, and now would be one of the best times?
I would say now is great. We're getting some good rain, so things might blow out a little bit, but it's going to level out really nicely, and the river level is going to be great. We're going to have some really good fishing coming up here. Once you get into July, that's when it's going to be the hardest. Not just because the water gets warm, but because of the pressure from people who are visiting, going fishing. These fish are seeing a lot of flies, and there are a lot of fly fishermen out there who are doing their best. It may be a little less educated on how to handle fish,
yes.
And some of these fish in warm water are just dying because they're not being released properly, or someone's taking a picture of them for too long, and that can put a damper on it too. So there's a lot of the summer produces human interference and environmental interference. So I would say July to the end of September. Nowadays, September is usually when traditionally when it used to kind of start to get good again, but now September is hotter than it's ever been. So pretty much October to July is going to be the best time to go, even in the middle of the winter.
You heard it from the lead guide and instructor at Jesse Brown's, Dave Bergman. Now is a fantastic time to go. With that being said, Dave, I got a couple of more questions here because Mother's Day is coming up, anniversaries for people are coming up, birthdays. I know for a fact that you've done some ladies-only trips. Talk to us. You mentioned, the machismo of a big water guy going offshore catching big fish, and talk to us about ladies coming into the sport of fly fishing and what you're seeing with the growth of women in the sport.
It is one of the fastest growing women's sports right now, and I will say this, most ladies do better than the men. There's no urge and goal to try to catch the biggest fish. There's no rush to gain the most experience. They really take it all in my experience. Most of the women I take are going to be much more open to new knowledge and pick it up a lot faster than the guys.
The hardest thing about this sport is picking a date to go. If you're interested in taking on the sport of fly fishing, building a foundation within the sport that you can enjoy for a lifetime, you can send an email to jesse@jessebrowns.com or call the shop. Book a trip, 704-556-0020. Dave Bergman, I do have, maybe this is not the right time to ask this question after what you just said. What's the biggest trout caught by a client with you on a wading trip after a day of fly fishing?
Let me dig through the years here. Well, I'll tell you the biggest one most recently was 23 inches.
Whoa.
And that was a spring season fish.
That'll work. 23 inches. That's a true trophy trout for sure. What about the smallest fish caught by a client?
We've definitely caught a couple like 5-inch smolts and little fingerlings before, and they'll eat the stuff. they'll eat even the big flies too. So you never know when you'll get those. That's how they grow, you know, get all that protein.
That's right. The smallest ones sometimes are the hungriest ones because they're the ones who have to grow up to be big.
Yeah, well, if you do wild trout trips on really small streams, you're not going to catch a lot of big, you know, fish, but you're going to catch a lot of those 8-inchers, but you'll maybe catch 100 in a day. So, the quantity over quality.
There's always that trade-off, and of course, I think that is something that picks up pace too, especially as the summer comes about. If we get deeper into summer, you go higher and higher up in altitude to enjoy catching the smaller trout in high numbers. Dave Bergman, thank you so much for taking some time for joining us here on the Carolina Outdoors and sharing your wisdom and knowledge with our listeners about the sport of fly fishing.
You're welcome.
Off he goes. And if you're interested in taking up the sport and joining in the club of fly fishing, Dave Bergman is available for trips. These are day trips from the city of Charlotte. We meet our clients on the river, so it doesn't matter exactly where you live. We will meet you on one of several trout streams that are utilized to help you get started in the sport. Again, you can email us, jesse@jessebrowns.com. Call us, 704-556-0020. And both of those options are also available at the website, jessebrowns.com. This is Bill Barty, host of the Carolina Outdoors. I'm going to take a quick break. You can also access us via Highlights of the Carolina Outdoors wherever you listen to podcasts, as well as the radio program as we blast up and down the Eastern Seaboard via the airwaves of WBT Radio. Saddle up, everybody. The Carolina Outdoors is now in session. Your host, Bill Barty, right here on this side of your radio dial. It's my pleasure to bring forth things for you to do in the Carolinas outdoor-wise and adventure-wise, and we have a gem here in the Carolinas. In fact, it's in the low country of South Carolina. It's an estuary system made up of wildlife, waterway, islands, plants, and more. Plus, it's the home of one of the top naturalists in the country. He's the CEO of Coastal Expeditions, educating and taking people around on adventure in this estuary system. In fact, he's made a career out of educating people across the country about this gem in South Carolina, and the clients that he takes out on experiences, never forget them. I'm one of those people, and I'm join me in welcoming Captain Chris Crawley of Coastal Expeditions. Chris, welcome to the program.
Hey, Barty. Man, how's it been going? Thanks for keeping me on your Rolodex. It's an exciting time to be in the coast of South in the coastal plain of South Carolina. So spot on the timing.
Well, and this is one of the reasons that you are one of the top naturalists. It's not just because of your 3-decade-plus career in getting people out and educating people. It's taking time to share with the Carolina Outdoors and more about what you have down there. And I guess we should start like this, Chris. It's springtime in the Carolinas, and you are out there on the waterway. You have guides and other naturalists that are taking people out as well. What's your favorite thing about the springtime in the creeks and rivers of the Charleston area?
Oh, man, Barty, it has been 30 years. It was 1992. We were incorporated. We were founded, and, you know, it's just like I'm so full of gratitude. I thank everybody. We've learned so much from doing it over the years, from the clients, and what it boils down to this time of year, it's like you got to be practiced at the art of living. You know, if you're practiced at the art of living in the low country, you're aware that right now that prothonotary warbler that's been holed up in Colombia, South America all winter is just arriving in the cypress trees in that Blackwater Cypress Tupelo bottomland forest to nest just feet away from where they were born. And that thousands of miles of migration brings them back to the low country. And that's like an indicator, right? The indicator is like, this is the best place to be in the world in the springtime. It's just amazing.
So true. And for our listeners out there, Chris, talk to us about, you know, I use words like estuary and ecosystem and that, but then you use the term black water, and I have it on my list. We'll talk a little bit about Ace Basin, or we'll talk a little bit about Francis Marion National Park, but educate us on what black water is.
So we'll, let's start at the ocean like the settlers did in this part of the world, and the Western European English settlers in 1670 started at the ocean on the barrier islands like Bull's Island and Cape Island, and even down around St. Helena Sound and what is now around modern-day Beaufort, South Carolina. And then they worked up the rivers exploring and employing cartographers to make the first accurate maps of the New World and meeting the indigenous people. And they worked up the river, and they worked up one of two kinds of rivers. They worked up a river that was born in the Appalachian mountain chain, up where the ancient human migration exists between the Appalachian Mountains and the coast. And they worked up a different kind of river that was born in the Piedmont, that was born in the sand hills at the fall line of South Carolina. And the waters of those intimate Piedmont-born rivers get stained by the tannic, fulvic, and humic acids of the deciduous trees that thrive in the riparian zone, the riverbanks, the floodplain. And it stains the water black, like a tea leaf would stain water a brown color for your sweet tea. So these black water rivers, that's what we call a black water river, is a river that's born in the Piedmont, that works its way down and falls into the inlets and estuary, creates the estuaries that join the open ocean. But as you follow them inland and you get around these towering, sometimes millennial, sometimes thousand-year-old cypress trees, the water is black like ink, and the reflection that's caused by this, you know, it's clean, but it's black tannic water, is amazing. The reflection of the trees, the reflection of the yellow birds, not just the Prothonotary warbler, but all of the birds that thrive in that ecosystem. The tanagers are in right now. It's another long migrant. The yellow-crowned night herons are nesting, and you can see their little kind of light blue eggs through the higgledy-piggledy twigs of their waterfront nests. We saw 120 white ibis kind of wading through that riparian zone, eating crawdads and crats and things like that the other day. It's you got to go. You know, I've got a 9-year-old and a 4-year-old, and they're beautiful, Mom. And we go there as a matter of habit every year so we can show the girls what that ecosystem looks like, what their natural heritage looks like in the Francis Marion National Forest, for example, that leads down into Cape Romaine National Wildlife Refuge.
Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about that because I introduced you, of course, and as you said, 1992, the CEO of Coastal Expeditions. And Chris, these days, in the days of jet skis and motorboats and ski boats and fishing boats and all of these, nothing against big motors on the back, but the best way, and what Coastal Expeditions has done and what you're doing now as a part of that education, is many times is taking the engine off. So these places, for the most part, and your guides and naturalists are doing this, are accessing this by boat, by kayak, by human-powered boat, I should say. Tell us about experiencing these places like that as opposed to, ooh, I shouldn't even say this. It's sacrilegious to say jet ski in these things.
Yeah, I tell you what, shout out to Chip Campson and the people that are on his committee that are getting that 96 bill passed that require boater education for all, so that you will have to have some kind of license to operate a powerboat. But, you know, it's like I heard the question, Barty, and that I'm gonna go tangent and give you a different kind of answer, because there is more pressure on the water these days with personal watercraft and boats with outboard engines than there has ever been in the history of Earth. And that's good and fine for people to get out and have a connection with nature and to do it sanely and in a sober way and in a way that's, you know, a family oriented, you know, wholesome way. The problem is that there's so much pressure on the beaches where the birds nest and rest, that it's interrupting their nesting cycle and their necessary resting cycle. If they're flying 2,000 or 3,000 miles from, if they're leaving northern Argentina to land hungry and tired in the, on the beaches of South Carolina, it's a hard place to find to land on the 4th of July, you know?
Oh, yes.
So there's a big movement that has to do with the ethical interaction with people on beaches and birds, especially people that love to boat with their dogs, which is all fine and good. It's just there's a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it. So that is something that you'll hear a lot more about: coastal squeeze and how to ethically interact with coastal birds, shorebirds and seabirds, important site fidelity, nesting grounds, rising water levels. There's a lot going on around those ecological topics today. But one of the ways we escape that is we leave the motor behind and we get into the self-powered boats and investigate these places that an outboard motor just can't go. Either the water isn't deep enough, there are too many strainers, or it's a wilderness area like the upper Wambaugh River that leads into the South Santee. Motors aren't allowed of any kind in the wilderness. And man, it's an aesthetic that's unlike any other. Quietly, gently easing up an intimate waterway, you know, but kind of weaving between the cypress knees and experiencing what that's like. It's ancient, you know, it's sort of a birthright, sort of a genomic heritage. That is how the Native Americans, the indigenous people, plied these waters thousands of years ago. I mean, these aren't the people we met. These are prehistoric Homo sapiens that paddled these creeks and rivers long before we ever got here. Oh, there's a painted bunting just came in.
Oh, you have to paint that picture here on the radio.
So painted buntings. Most of our painted buntings, if my information is current and correct, are coming from the island of Cuba in the Caribbean. And so the painted bunting is Passerina cirrus. They're a bird about the size of a sparrow, and they're certainly a neotropical New World migrant. And they are the most colorful songbird in North America. I'd put them up against just about any songbird, pound for pound for color. They're blue and red and yellow and green, and there's this one color they do that's a mix between pink and purple. It's just hard to describe, but they come in, they're gregarious enough. The males come in and they stake their territory and they sing and sing this complicated, beautiful, warbling song. And the female, it's a lime green bird, comes in and responds to that, and they nest right here in the Lowcountry. They're coming for thousands of miles to paradise. They're coming to you know, they're coming to your house, man.
Ladies and gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, this is why he is one of the top naturalists in the United States, Captain Chris Crawley of Coastal Expeditions, because he helps lead the way, whether it's from a kayak or a walk on a beach, or painting that picture here on the radio so that you can see into that saltwater estuary system where he lives and shares it via radio. Hey, Chris, with that, I need to ask you a quick question, especially for our listeners, because down there in the area where you are, there is edible mud. Can you talk to us about edible mud?
You know, ecosystems are the same no matter where you go, Barty. On Earth, as an earthling, yes. you recognize that ecosystems all have producers, consumers, and decomposers. You know, and the producers are the plants, and the consumers are mammals like us, and the decomposers are the fungus and algae and the things that break other things down. And most ecosystems, when you talk about the tertiary, like the ground, the dirt, like the sand in the desert, is considered abiotic or non-living, right?
Yes.
But here, where the rivers meet the ocean, the very mud, the pluff mud or plow mud that the spirobolus grass, the spartina grass grows in, is so nutrient-rich. It's this biogenic ooze that's full of nitrogen and anaerobic bacteria, and it's so nutrient-rich that the biology community, the scientists, consider it a biotic element of the ecosystem. So the salt marsh estuary, one of the top three most super biodiversified ecosystems on Earth, is so rich and so abundant, so alive, that you can actually eat the mud, the biotic mud, and be nourished by it. So that's the pluff mud or plow mud that the Sea Island cotton farmers use to regenerate their fallow fields after a cotton crop back in the back in 17-something, and that is where, Bartie, the South Carolina state reptile, loggerhead sea turtle, is showing up right now while we're talking. These 300-pound sea turtles are meeting up in the deep spots of the salt marsh estuary where the Spartina grass, the Crassostrea, the eastern oyster, the pluff mud, and the salt water all build this ecosystem, and they're pair bonding and mating, and they are, and they're on their way to lay their eggs on the beaches of our barrier islands right here, probably about the first week of May, maybe second week of May.
Yeah, you know, I have this on my list, and you were talking about the pressure on the beaches, etiquette on the beaches, whether it's human or our pets and everywhere in between, that sort of that conversation of beach etiquette. And I have May means loggerhead turtles where you are. Tell us that interaction as they make their way to the beach. I guess they'll hatch in July or so, mid-July to August. How should we act? How should we be? Of course, there are active turtle agencies who are helping mark the nesting grounds, but can you give us some advice on what we'll see and how we should act?
I definitely, if you're out in your powerboat and you see a big football-shaped head come up out of the water in the creek that you're winding through, I'd say chop the throttle and idle on. But give that big turtle some time and space to get out of the way of that powerboat. A lot of the turtle mortalities that we see right now are when the turtles get real thick, has to do with boat strike. And certainly if you know where a nest is or see a turtle on the beach, you'd give that a wide berth and leave that alone. Or later in the summer, if you see a boil or a hatching, you'd want to steer clear of that. If a turtle's coming up the beach, don't bother her, because she will abandon her quest if she feels like it's an unsafe place for eggs. But South Carolina is a superlative in a lot of things, and some of those things aren't things that we're very proud of as a native South Carolinian, but some of them are so rich and good, like more barrier islands than any other state except for Florida, more estuary than any other state except for Louisiana, and we've got more nesting loggerhead sea turtles than anywhere on the East Coast of the United States north of Cape Canaveral. Like in Cape Romaine alone, not even counting the great projects going on Dewey's Island and Solomon's Island and the Isle of Palms and Kiowa and Seabrook, but in Cape Romaine alone, there were 3,311 nests just last year, and that wasn't the biggest year they've ever seen. It's amazing.
Wow. You've worked with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for decades. What do they say about the population? Are we making inroads as far as the protections that we want to or need to with the loggerhead?
Well, they when they look back at the history, there's a lot of, we could do a program on just loggerhead sea turtles and talk about the relevant science that's finally coming through about Coretta, our state reptile, and their site fidelity, where they're nesting, who they are, who they're nesting next to, and that sort of thing. The University of Georgia is carrying on some really great genetic studies. But when they leave the beach, it's like whatever half-dollar size turtles, they don't come back for something like 30 years. And it
right.
just so happens that the Turtle Project in Cape Romaine, which is sort of it'll be the star in the crown of Sarah Dossie, the current refuge manager at Cape Romaine, it has been going on for about 30 years. And I think that it's not science, but it is easy to sort of speculate that due to the nest protection, predator threat reduction, and all of the good work that's going on in Cape Romaine, that's why the numbers are so high. There's a team of volunteers starting May 1st that's going to start going out there to Cape Island and Lighthouse Island and protecting nests and relocating nests and marking nests and taking genetic samples and caging nests and so forth. And they'll go out 7 days a week until the end of September,
wow.
rain or shine. And the two wildlife biologist technicians that are the key to that program, that are sort of 1099 independent contractors, are paid, their salaries are paid through the efforts of the Coastal Expeditions Foundation, with generous support through Boeing, South Carolina, and our own fundraising and grassroots efforts. And that's sort of how we're contributing to those wild people that help those wild animals in those wild places.
Well, and it makes sense because Coastal Expeditions helps get people out. And I encourage our listeners, if you're in the Charleston area or even not, it's worth a trip. You have locations from the Isle of Palms to Folly Beach, Mount Pleasant, Bulls Island. You're running these Blackwater Rivers. I think you may go to a few other places that aren't listed as well. But go back to that foundation, because Coastal Expeditions Foundation is being recognized as giving back to the wildlife. Can we access that so we can give via coastalexpeditions.com?
Yeah, that's a great thanks for mentioning it, Barto. It was like we had said before, my dear friend Dana Beach told me one time that if you're doing the good work, if you're doing work people care about, mm-hmm. then they'll give you money for it. And we are a self-funded foundation with corporate sponsors, and our real strength is in our grassroots and our individual donors that have watched what we're doing and been part of what we're doing for the last 30 years. And the Coastal Expeditions Foundation is easy to Google, and just like everything these days, there's a donate now button on every page. But again, we were super lucky to get the attention of Boeing South Carolina that appreciates what we're doing for post-traumatic stress-affected veterans and wild people, wild places, and wild animals. And we're looking forward to expanding the role of the foundation into our newest outpost and location that we were going to call Coastal Expeditions South, but we got down there and fell in love with it, so we call it Coastal Expeditions Beaufort. And we are we're doing quite a great business down there with Henry Brandt and his crew running Coastal Expeditions Beaufort and going out to St. Philip's Island and partnering with the SCPRT at Hunting Island State Park. So we're proud of the foundation, and we're looking forward to getting some why and behind the how of what we're doing in Beaufort, South Carolina, too.
And I know Mr. Brandt is running some May trips as well, so you can access those trips with him at CoastalExpeditions.com as well. Kids programs, camps, field trips, as you mentioned, the Veterans Resilience Program, paddling instruction. It goes on. And Captain Chris Crawley, I've kept you past the time I was supposed to. We got to do it again. Thank you for being on the Carolina Outdoors with us.
Hey, Barty, you're the voice, man. You're the storyteller. I appreciate you keeping me as part of the story. I look forward to hearing from you soon, brother.
So good. There he goes, Captain Chris Crawley. The feeling is mutual. Please join in. We're going to take a quick break, come back on the other side, and wrap this up, this thing called the Carolina Outdoors. Wrapping up the Carolina Outdoors. If you missed this edition of the Carolina Outdoors, do not worry. You can head back to jessebrowns.com, click on podcast, highlights of the Carolina Outdoors. If you like what you hear, rate and review us. It helps other people find us. You can find it wherever podcasts are held as well. And on this episode of the Carolina Outdoors, we had a great visit with Captain Chris Crawley of Coastal Expeditions and learned a little bit about paddling the coast and the backwaters of the Lowcountry of South Carolina. And springtime is a great time for you to take on that endeavor. The other side of the coin, of course, is heading for Western North Carolina and taking up the sport of fly fishing. We were glad to have Dave Bergman on from Jesse Brown's. He's the lead guide and instructor to kind of lay down the format of what May offers. The delayed harvest program of catch and release fly fishing is well underway, but now is the time to seize into that sport, and it is available as well at jessebrowns.com. My name is Bill Barty. For TJ the DJ Boggs, who's on the other side of the glass working the dials, we invite you to make the Carolina Outdoors look a little bit better than you find it, and pick up your trash.